From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Secret Space Program. Boy, do we have a great program for you in store tonight, all night long. Here's what's happening. Two people killed in an accident that involved, get this, at least 40 vehicles on Interstate 96 in Michigan. The accident happened before 10 a.m. Fire officials were working almost into the night looking for more victims. The extent of other injuries unknown at this time. Bad weather, fog, everything else out there. An earthquake of magnitude 6.5 reported 102 miles west of Ferndale off of Northern California. People as far away as San Francisco reported the quake, but the immediate reports of damage not known. Officials did not issue a tsunami warning, but a lot of people were a little uptight thinking, uh-oh, is this the big one? I'm sure glad that I've had an opportunity to live during some of the most incredible times in the history of this planet. And especially witnessing, of course, mankind going into space, John Glenn orbiting planet Earth. John Glenn is no longer with us. John Glenn, the All-American astronaut, the senator who rocketed into history on flights 36 years apart as the first American to orbit the Earth and the oldest person in space, has died at the age of 95. Glenn died at the James Cancer Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. He had been hospitalized there for more than a week. Glenn, who was known for his small-town decency and calm heroics, was the last of the original Mercury 7 astronauts who launched the U.S. space program. He later served for four terms as a Democratic senator from Ohio. Space historian and our science advisor, Robert Zimmerman. Robert, what a great man John Glenn was, and he's going to be missed.
He, like the other original seven astronauts, were American heroes, and they took a gamble with their lives to help get us into space at the very beginning of the space race in the 1960s. Glenn had a very interesting life, George, in that he actually had like four different careers. He was a jet pilot.
Yeah.
He was fought in World War II and in Korea. A pilot. Then he was a test pilot. He actually set a supersonic record and got a ticker tape parade for it. Not many people remember this. And then he was an astronaut of great success. And then he nestled between his two astronaut flights. He was a senator.
Yeah, and a presidential hopeful. He almost had that.
Yes, and so this is a man of many talents, but then all the astronauts with them. But they were really, in a sense, when I've met astronauts, I've always been surprised in many ways how ordinary they are. And that, to me, that's not to denigrate them. That's to tell everyone that everyone has the potential to be as great as they are. They simply made it happen. And I think that's just that's the best symbol and memory we can get from John Glenn. He was an ordinary guy growing up in an ordinary way who decided to do great things, and he achieved them magnificently.
Oh, he sure did. And I just, at 76, when he went up in the space shuttle, Robert, I just couldn't imagine it. But I said, this guy's got, he's got guts.
Well, you know.
He's got the right stuff.
He wanted to go up again. He had done it once, and he didn't fly again during the whole 60s program for a lot of reasons, and he wanted to go again, and he had the opportunity. He pulled strings politically. He had the ability to do that, and he got his flight, and I think it's a great thing. In many ways, it demonstrated that even at 77, human beings can experience weightlessness and survive, do a flight in space.
The right stuff indeed. Thank you. Robert Zimmerman, our space historian and science advisor. One of the fundamental ways scientists measure the well-being of a nation is tracking the rate at which its citizens die and how long they can be expected to live. So the news out of the federal government is kind of disturbing, folks. The overall U.S. death rate has increased for the first time in a decade, according to an analysis of the latest data. And that led to a drop in overall life expectancy for the first time since 1993, particularly among people younger than 65 years old. Something's going wrong. And listen to this story. A Santa in North Carolina is accused of fat-shaming a young little boy. Anthony Mays, he was 9 years old, was excited to see Santa sit on his lap, tell him about the iPod Touch he wanted, the drone that he wanted for Christmas. But what did this Santa do? He told little Anthony, lay off the hamburgers, basically telling him he's too fat. Walmart's Mexico unit will invest $1.3 billion over the next 3 years. The CEO of Walmart of Mexico said the money will go toward bolstering the company's logistics, infrastructure, building new distribution centers, and expanding existing ones. More than 10,000 new permanent direct jobs will be created in Mexico. Donald Trump's latest Twitter target is Indiana union leader Chuck Jones. After sparring with Boeing over the alleged soaring cost of the next Air Force One, the president-elect Trump is now in a social media clash with the head of the United Steelworkers, Local 1999. After Jones criticized his deal to discourage air conditioner manufacturer Carrier Corporation from closing an Indiana factory and moving jobs to Mexico. According to the Indiana union leader, who was attacked by Trump in the tweets, he says, I have no regrets about calling the president-elect a liar for his claims about saving jobs at Carrier. He went on to tell people that he was going to save 1,100 jobs. It's only 800. The other 300 are white-collar jobs, and they never plan to be shipped to Mexico anyway. Howard Bloom is with us. And, of course, Howard, this is you're an expert in public relations. Why is the president-elect engaging like this?
Well, he cannot tolerate. He's a very strange man, and it's a little scary to have him as president. He isn't capable of accepting any kind of criticism. So he's setting up a new normal. You praise him in public or you suffer the consequences. So he attacked a little guy, as you said, Chuck Jones, the president of United Steelworkers 1999 in Indiana, a little guy. And he attacked him twice. Chuck Jones, who is president of United Steelworkers 1999, he says, has done a terrible job representing workers. No wonder companies flee the country. That was Wednesday, last night. At 7:41, an hour later, he just couldn't lay off the Twitter, and he said if United States Steelworkers 1999 was any good, they would have kept those jobs in Indiana, spend more time working, less time talking, reduce taxes. But then the really dangerous thing happened. It's not just that Donald Trump feels free to attack people far, far smaller in power than he is, but Trump supporters backed him by threatening the local union leader in a long string of phone calls saying, basically, I know what kind of car you drive, you've got kids, I know where you live, and that kind of harassment is a threat to Americans' freedom of speech.
That's now, not good, Howard.
Yeah, Donald Trump did something terrific. He saved between 730 and 800 jobs. But 500 jobs are still going to Mexico. So Trump went in front of an audience at the Carrier factory in Indianapolis and said that he had saved 1,100 jobs. Now, to you and me, that seems like a minor difference.
Right. It does. But you know, if I were Donald Trump, I would have said today, Chuck is right. It's 800 jobs. That's the final tally. That's still a great job.
It's a great job. He should have taken credit. He should have been honest. But he couldn't leave it alone. And Chuck Jones was painfully aware of those 550 pink slips that were about to go out. This guy had offered Carrier $23 million a year in concessions, and that wasn't enough for Carrier. According to Jones, the Carrier negotiator said that the union workers would have to accept pay below the U.S. minimum wage to match the savings the company could expect from a move to Mexico. So Mike Pence, who was governor of Indiana, had the soon-to-be vice president of the United States, jumped in, and Carrier told him, don't even bother to offer us tax concessions. So Trump accomplished something astonishing, but he does not have to exaggerate, he does not have to lie, and he certainly should not be attacking people as any of those of us who are citizens of the United States, and he shouldn't be encouraging his audience, as he did on Tuesday night, to become angry and to become their own vigilantes. And he did that when he was speaking, when he was introducing Mattis.
His advisors, Howard, have got to step in and cut him off Twitter and things like that. I mean, it's going to get worse before it gets better, and he just can't do that. He's going to be the president. Hey, we've got an incredible story for you at coasttocoastam.com. A tiny piglet born with the face of a monkey has baffled everybody who has seen it. You can go look at it, too. The little piglet was born in China. What else is going on these days in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, good evening, George. And I'd like to preface tonight by saying I hope that someday someone can prove to me that there's no such thing as a UFO. I have six reports in front of me that suggest that's not the case, that they are real, and I'm becoming alarmed by the nature of reports that are continuing to come to the National UFO Reporting Center. I find it somewhat unsettling, but the first of a few reports I'd like to present comes from 3 weeks ago. Jordan, Montana, a young woman writes that she was out driving by herself. This is a remote part of Montana, just south of Fort Peck Reservoir. Suddenly, the area around her car and as far as she could see just lit up like it was daylight. She glanced around quickly and saw in the eastern sky a green fireball. Under ordinary circumstances, George, I'd say, well, it was just a meteor. We're struck by 10 to the 12th power meteors every day on this planet, except the illumination continued for the better part of a minute, way, way too long for the overwhelming majority of meteors. Very interesting case, and that one's posted to our website. Second one I'd like to present, arrived just an hour and a half ago, comes from Corte Madera, California. That's just about 20 miles north of the Golden Gate Bridge in Sausalito. Gentleman writes that last Saturday night, the 3rd of December, he was at his home. He was looking to the mountains to the east, and he saw a crimson-red disc or cigar-shaped object rise above the hills in the distance and just hover against the hills and maneuver very slowly, very close to the ground, he estimates. He points out that when it slowed down or approached being very close to the ground, the color of it changed, went from crimson to burnt orange or even a darker color than that. Very interesting report. Not posted yet. That one arrived just an hour and a half ago, but we'll have it posted to our website very soon. The next report is very unsettling to me. It comes from down in the L.A. area, Huntington Beach.
Know it well.
Just down, right on the shoreline. Young woman, I've spoken with her twice. She speaks very eloquently, very precisely. She writes the same, and she's apparently a very skilled artist. But she describes that last Sunday night, the 4th of December, 10:40 p.m., she left a friend's apartment, was walking to her car in a parking lot, and her attention was drawn by the beautifully clear sky. She looked up, and a boomerang-shaped object, how many times have we heard about those? Many. Glided right over her head, headed generally southeast, so over the water. She's written a very nice report, which is posted to our website. We link to it from our homepage, and she's provided two excellent illustrations of what it all looked like. Very interesting report. The really interesting part of it is the object suddenly, at the end of her sighting of it, executed a 180-degree turn in a very short period of time, and it had two gray lights, possibly three gray lights, on its ventral surface. I recommend people take a look at her drawings on our website. Next report comes from two nights ago, Holland, Pennsylvania. A gentleman, a businessman, successful businessman, was walking outside a schoolyard, saw a red light go right over his head, and it illuminated a thick growth of forest quite brightly, he points out. The last he saw of it was going over a nearby ridge near, I think it's Neshaminy High School. Other people, no doubt, must have seen that. If anybody saw it, I would encourage them to get in touch with our center and submit a written report. Last report I'd like to present comes from Austin, Nevada. This is two nights ago, George.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
a young couple were driving. They were in two vehicles, a moving truck and their personal vehicle, and they saw a yellow light come down out of the sky. At first, they thought it was a shooting star, but it was the wrong color, distinctly yellow or possibly orange. It stopped while both of them were looking at it from their respective vehicles, split off a second yellow light, then a third. Then they all extinguished. Another one came on and started maneuvering throughout the sky. Very interesting report. Not yet posted to our website, but it will be over the weekend. Lots going on for sure.
Excellent. Peter, thank you so much. Up next, we're going to be talking about Tools of Titans, the tactics, routines, and habits of billionaires, loons, and world-class performers, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Tim Ferriss with us has been listed as one of the Fast Company's most innovative business people, one of Forbes' names you need to know, and one of Fortune's 40 under 40. He's an early-stage technology investor and advisor to some companies like Uber, one of our sponsors, Facebook, Shopify, Duolingo, Alibaba, and so many others. And also a New York Times best-selling author. We're talking about Tools of Titans tonight. Tim, welcome to the program. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You have really done a remarkable job looking at the tactics and the brain power of really some heavy hitters on this planet. And you've gotten involved with a lot of them as well. How did this all start for you?
It started with finding good weather in California, I suppose. Out of college, I was an East Coaster, and I got tired of the gray. I was born and raised in New York, and moved to Silicon Valley, and found a very high density of extremely eccentric and interesting people parked up there, and I've been there for close to 17 years now, and I think just by proximity have ended up interacting in the beginning with some very outlandish characters who have since become very influential, but didn't start that way. And at one point, 2007, 2008, became involved with tech investing, and that really opened a lot of doors to connect with people in other worlds outside of tech. Because, of course, even though the tools might be first created in Silicon Valley, many of them, like Facebook, Twitter, and others, end up being used worldwide. So I think that's how I ended up interacting with, at least at this point, a very diverse range of characters, all the way from four-star generals to, of course, the usual, perhaps, billionaires in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, but also black market biochemists and all sorts of interesting options, I suppose.
Did the people who helped steer and push the internet in the early stages ever think of the possibilities of how big things could get after that? The example is, God rest his soul now, Steve Jobs. I mean, he and Wozniak invented the Apple computer, and it was hardware, and then they did their own little software with it. But did they ever think about, you know, the Facebooks and the Ubers and those possibilities and the Amazons and what could happen after that? Because they could have gotten into all that too.
I think if they had that gift of perfect foresight, then they could have quadrupled and 100x'd the fortunes they built. But I remember hearing at one point from Peter Thiel, who's in the news a lot, of course, but a serial billionaire nonetheless, very, very adept entrepreneur and investor. I mean, certainly once you're lucky, twice you're good. 10 times or 50 times, something really interesting has gone on.
Yeah.
And he has said somewhat famously, you know, if you're imitating Facebook or you're imitating Twitter or you're imitating fill-in-the-blank person that you think is changing the world, then you're not learning the lesson you should be learning from them, which is you have to be zigging when other people are zagging. So it's very difficult oftentimes to predict the impact that something that seems trivial might have. For instance, Twitter's a great example of this. Twitter started off as a way to tell people what kind of burrito you had. A lot of people still do that. But it started off as someone, in this case Jack Dorsey,
From St. Louis, where I am right now, as a matter.
That's right. That's right. And Jack is a polymath. He started off making this thing that ended up being called Twitter to scratch his own itch. And it wasn't even the product that the company was making at the time, in fact. And now, flash forward, all these unexpected emergent uses have had it used as a tool of political revolution.
Well, that's an interesting point. Tim, hold on the line. We're going to hit this break, but we're going to come right back with much more with you. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you, Tim Ferriss with us. Tim, of course, his latest book is called Tools of Titans, but he's got some other bestsellers out there. It's called The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Work Week, and The 4-Hour Chef. And Tim, how does these three books differ from Tools of Titans?
Well, the first three books were comprehensive books and took some time to go from A to Z in those. Tools of Titans, because it's really the cliff notes, the cheat sheets for the 200-plus world-class performers that I've interviewed, so their routines, habits, etc. Each chapter is basically a mini book, and so it's intended to give you something that you can consume and use with one cup of coffee. 5 to 15 pages, maybe 10 minutes, and you have something that you can apply that day or that week. So it's intended to be more of a choose your own adventure book, I'd say, more of a reference book than a big honkin' A to Z type of project.
Have you found, when you looked at some of these habits of billionaires, that there are lots of similarities between these people?
You find a lot of similarities across the, say, top 1% in any field. And what I mean by that is, if you look at, say, billionaire tech investor, then you look at the best respected hospice care physician who's helped 1,000 people die, and then you look at the top, say, researcher as it relates to, you name it, some type of specific molecule who's shortlisted for the Nobel Prize. They will have more in common with one another than they have with the B and C players in their own field. And I'll give you some examples. I'd say more than 80% of the people I've interviewed have some type of morning mindfulness practice that could be meditation. So it could be as simple as using an app like Headspace or listening to a guided meditation. There's one woman named Maria Popova who's just an incredible, incredible writer and has built a gigantic following of like maybe 7 to 10 million people per month who read her work. And she listens to the same 2010 summer smile meditation by a woman named Tara Brach. And that name came up a number of times. But it can also take the form of exercise where people count, say, the speed of each repetition of lifting weights, 5 seconds up, 5 seconds down. Mm-hmm. Anything that helps them to train themselves to be less reactive throughout the day so they can make better decisions. That was one that was very common. Another was using weird gadgets to help sleep, gadgets and also concoctions. So there's, for instance, a device called the Chili Pad. A legendary music producer named Rick Rubin introduced this to me, and then a number of athletes, elite athletes, mentioned it, called the Chili Pad, which allows you to cool the surface of your bed to a specific temperature or heat it between 55 degrees and like 90 degrees. And it is just a complete game changer for me and some of my closest friends who have tried it. It's been the single biggest change in their quality of life. So those are a few that come to mind right off the bat.
You sleep better when the bed is cool?
Absolutely. And not only that, but for people who have a significant other in the bed, and if you operate at slightly different temperatures, which is almost always the case, there's no more throwing the leg over the bed sheets and under and fighting over the thermostat. That's all fixed. So it's also good for your marriage, I suppose.
The traits of some of these people, are they all generally, most of them, would you consider them good people?
I would consider that. That's one of my selection criteria. I would say that it's hard, unless I'm very, very close to all of these people, to say with any degree of certainty. But in general, I'd say yes, because I'm trying to select people who are not only successful, meaning they have achieved a lot, but who are also content and self-aware. In other words, they actually have some degree of happiness. And that is not as common as you might expect among, say, the top percent in technology. You meet routinely, or I shouldn't say you in general, but I routinely meet people with tens or hundreds of millions of dollars who are completely miserable. And when you filter those people out and focus on the people who seem to have figured out both sides of the coin, they tend to be good people, in my opinion.
Let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump, a little bit off the pathway here. But,
sure.
You know, his trade is apparently he's a billionaire, did very well with the money his father gave him to get started. Yes, he's filed bankruptcies. Yes, he's involved in a lot of suits. What business person isn't that, you know, that is out there doing it? But what about his traits? How do you look at that? And specifically, Tim, I want to cite an example today of the Twitter argument he's been getting into with the United Steelworkers in Indiana over, you know, Trump saving some jobs in Indianapolis from the Carrier Company, the furnace air conditioning company, where he said, look, I've saved 1,100 jobs. And in actuality, apparently, it's only 800 jobs. And so there's been this fiery Twitter response back and forth between him and the union leader. Why does he engage in that? He doesn't have to.
Yeah, you know, this is, I think, probably above my pay grade.
I don't think so, but go ahead.
I can take a stab at it, but I have always had a cautious interest in the political world, but have generally avoided most news because I find it difficult to distinguish between theater and fact. And I also find it difficult to distinguish between sort of strategy and real strategy, in the sense that I don't think Trump is a dumb guy.
No, he couldn't be to get to where he is today.
Exactly. And so I do think, at the same time, he would be the first to admit and paint this certainly as an advantage in a lot of respects. He doesn't have a lot of experience in the political sphere. So do I think it is a great use of his bandwidth to get baited into Twitter exchanges? I do not. But perhaps he has just skipped the K-12 and high school education equivalent that other politicians have in not engaging those types of disputes publicly.
Well, see, it just seems to me, Tim, the guy's going to be the president in a month, a month and a week and a half or so. And, I mean, he is going to face an inordinate amount of hate mail and texts and criticism that comes with the job, and you got to be able to let that roll off you. You can't engage in all of these, and you know, 50%, more than 50% of the people of the voters voted for Hillary, so he's got more than half of the people who don't like him, and you know, if they all sent him tweets, my God, would he spend the rest of his presidency trying to answer them? So I don't get why he just doesn't say, hey, I'm the elected president. I've got more money than I need. I'm healthy. I've got a great family. I'm not going to engage in this. And I don't get why he does that.
I don't know what the motivation is. I will say that I think it will be, at least in this particular example, self-correcting. And there are a few things. And again, speaking as someone who is, I think, completely unqualified to speak on such things, but I'll say the first is that even most people in the U.S. thought Obama was going to be a savior and fix the multitude of our problems, and he wasn't. I think that a lot of people expect Trump to create the apocalypse, and I don't think that is terribly likely. But I remember, for instance, I've written four books now, and I've thousands and probably tens of thousands of messages directed at me on social media now, many of which are crazy people or people who simply have decided that I am the spawn of Satan. And
well, the internet has bred haters, and they're there. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. They're out there, and if you engage them, they're going to hate even more. I've been involved in stuff like that in the beginning of my career, and it's a waste of time.
No, it is, but I think that that is something you learn with time, and I'll give you an example. I remember the first time I got a really atrocious, hateful one-star review for my first book. I remember this, and I wrote this impassioned, logical response on Amazon. It took me an hour or two to write this response, and I'm not sure what the cursing policy is on this program, but
No cursing.
Okay, I won't curse, but I awaited this, oh, thanks for writing that, Tim. Now I understand your argument, and it was just basically a wave of the hand and a string of five profanities, and I was like, oh, maybe that's how the internet works. And over time I realized, and it didn't take very long, that just by sheer exposure to this, almost like getting a suntan, you're like, okay, after 5 or 6 days, you develop a tolerance, or maybe it's better thought of as like a flu shot. And I think Trump is going to be so deluged and overwhelmed.
You may be right.
With those types of inputs, he's going to have no choice but to, I think, dramatically curtail or completely stop most of it.
You say that meditation is a very important aspect of some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, I think that, and it goes hand in hand with a few other things, and I'll explain why I think it's important.
Okay.
As someone who always had an allergic reaction to the word meditation, by the way, the type A-driven, ram my head through walls type of character for decades. I just associated the word meditation with sanctimonious yoga teachers and didgeridoo players and all sorts of folks that I didn't necessarily identify with. But meditation accomplishes in part what Stoic philosophy also helps a lot of these people to accomplish. And that's another common thread that popped up. There are a lot of people in this book who read the writing of people who've been dead for 2,000 years, Marcus Aurelius, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Seneca the Younger, Cato, Epictetus. These come up with really mind-boggling frequency in these interviews. And if you look at the common thread, it is that these people are using practices like meditation, and they're using philosophical operating systems, if you want to think about it that way, to become more aware of their own thoughts, including those thoughts that may be repeating stories or narratives that are unhelpful and untrue. And they are also consuming the writing and doing the practices to become less emotionally overreactive. And in fact, and I didn't plan on reading this, but one of my routines, and this is adopted from many of the people that I interviewed, is actually reading a quote. I'll make it short. It's pretty long, but I'll shorten it. This is a quote from Marcus Aurelius, who is the, at one point, emperor of...
I remember him in The Gladiator with Russell Crowe, right? Played by Richard Harris.
On the planet. Yeah, most powerful man on the planet at the time, and he used to tell himself, this is from one of his journals, and I read this to myself each morning, quote, "When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. They are like this because they can't tell good from evil. But I have seen the beauty of good and the ugliness of evil, and have recognized that the wrongdoer has a nature related to my own, ... And it goes on, and so none of them can hurt me, on. And this is to set my mind into a state whereby I'm prepared for the worst-case scenarios that could occur, and I'm not unnecessarily thrown off during the day. Meditation helps you to accomplish the same thing, and it depends on the type of meditation you choose, but for whatever reason, a lot of men in this book seem to ultimately arrive at transcendental meditation. A lot of the women in the book tend to land at something called Vipassana meditation, which is a contemplative meditation, but really all it means at the end of the day is sitting quietly and observing your thoughts and becoming aware of certain patterns that occur. And it doesn't have to be esoteric. It doesn't have to be woo-woo. It doesn't have to have any religious connotations. It is simply a practice. While, for instance, you're sitting on your couch in the morning, when there are no stakes in a safe environment, you're practicing becoming non-reactive so that it does matter when you're in a negotiation, when you're asking your boss for a raise, when someone cuts you off in traffic, you don't overreact and cause a lot of damage to yourself or other people.
Road rage. It's at an epidemic, Tim.
Road rage is no good for anyone.
In my theory of road rage, a bad or rude driver does something to somebody who's having an uptight day. And it's that per person who's having his uptight day, you know, driving in his car, thinking about the moments, and somebody does something like that to him, and he loses it. And he goes, you know, very, very rarely is the road rager the bad driver. It's the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that this awareness of thought and training yourself to be resilient and detached in a way that you can observe yourself and act dispassionately when the stakes are high or when stress is high is definitely a meta skill and a pattern across all these folks. And they go about it different ways. Some people use, for instance, they might do 500 meters using an ergometer. It's a rowing machine. Or they might do 20 kettlebell swings in the morning. There are a lot of different ways to do it.
They get it out of their system. Tim, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Tools of Titans, and we'll also take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.